The sixth book of the Dialogues of Lucius Annaeus Seneca, of Consolation, Address to Marcia, translated by Aubrey Stewart and narrated by Robin Homer. 1. Did I not know, Marcia, that you have as little of a woman's weakness of mind as of her other vices, and that your life was regarded as a pattern of antique virtue, I should not have dared to combat your grief, which is one that many men fondly nurse and embrace, nor should I have conceived the hope of persuading you to hold Fortune blameless, having to plead for her at such an unfavourable time, before so partial a judge, and against such an odious charge. I derive confidence, however, from the proved strength of your mind and your virtue, which has been proved by a severe test. All men know how well you behaved towards your father, whom you loved as dearly as your children in all respects, save that you did not wish him to survive you. Indeed, for all that I know, you may have wished that also, for great affection ventures to break some of the golden rules of life. You did all that lay in your power to avert the death of your father, Aulus Cremutius Cordus, but when it became clear that, surrounded as he was by the Myrmidons of Sejanus, there was no other way of escape from slavery, you did not approve of his resolution, but gave up all attempts to oppose it. You shed tears openly and choked down your sobs, yet did not screen them behind a smiling face. And you did all this in the present century, when not to be unnatural towards one's parents is considered the height of filial affection. When the changes of our times gave you an opportunity, you restored to the use of man that genius of your father for which he had suffered, and made him in real truth immortal by publishing as an eternal memorial of him those books which that bravest of men had written with his own blood. You have done a great service to Roman literature. A large part of Cordus's books had been burned. A great service to posterity, who will receive a true account of events, which cost its author so dear. And a great service to himself, whose memory flourishes and will ever flourish as long as men set any value upon the facts of Roman history, as long as anyone lives who wishes to review the deeds of our fathers, to know what a true Roman was like, one who still remained unconquered when all other necks were broken in to receive the yoke of Sejanus, one who was free in every thought, feeling, and act. By Hercules, the state would have sustained a great loss if you had not brought him forth from the oblivion to which his two splendid qualities, eloquence and independence, had consigned him. He is now read, is popular, is received into men's hands and bosoms, and fears no old age. But as for those who butchered him, before long men will cease to speak even of their crimes, the only things by which they are remembered. This greatness of mind in you has forbidden me to take into consideration your sex or your face, still clouded by the sorrow by which so many years ago it was suddenly overcast. See, I shall do nothing underhand, nor try to steal away your sorrows. I have reminded you of old hurts, and to prove that your present wound may be healed, I have shown you the scar of one which was equally severe. Let others use soft measures and caresses. I have determined to do battle with your grief, and I will dry those weary and exhausted eyes, which already, to tell you the truth, are weeping more from habit than from sorrow. I will effect this cure, if possible, with your good will. If you disapprove of my efforts or dislike them, then you must continue to hug and fondle the grief which you have adopted as the survivor of your son. What, I pray you, is to be the end of it? All means have been tried in vain. The consolations of your friends, who are weary of offering them, and the influence of great men who are related to you. Literature, a taste which your father enjoyed and which you have inherited from him, now finds your ears closed and affords you but a futile consolation, which scarcely engages your thoughts for a moment. Even time itself, nature's greatest remedy, which quiets the most bitter grief, loses its power with you alone. 3 years have already passed, and still your grief has lost none of its first poignancy, but renews and strengthens itself day by day, and has now dwelt so long with you that it has acquired a domicile in your mind, and actually thinks that it would be base to leave it. All vices sink into our whole being if we do not crush them before they gain a footing, and in like manner the sad, pitiable, and discordant feelings end by feeding upon their own bitterness, until the unhappy mind takes a sort of morbid delight in grief. I should have liked, therefore, to have attempted to effect this cure in the earliest stages of the disorder, before its force was fully developed. It might have been checked by milder remedies, but now it has been confirmed by time, it cannot be beaten without a hard struggle. In like manner, wounds heal easily when the blood is fresh upon them. They can be cleared out and brought to the surface, and admit of being probed by the finger. When disease has turned them into malignant ulcers, their cure is more difficult. I cannot now influence so strong a grief by polite and mild measures. It must be broken down by force. 2. I am aware that all who wish to give anyone advice begin with precepts and end with examples, but it is sometimes useful to alter this fashion, for we must deal differently with different people. Some are guided by reason. Others must be confronted with authority and the names of celebrated persons, whose brilliancy dazzles their mind and destroys their power of free judgment. I will place before your eyes two of the greatest examples belonging to your sex and your century. One, that of a woman who allowed herself to be entirely carried away by grief. The other, one who, though afflicted by a like misfortune and an even greater loss, yet did not allow her sorrows to reign over her for a very long time, but quickly restored her mind to its accustomed frame. Octavia and Livia, the former Augustus's sister, the latter his wife, both lost their sons when they were young men and when they were certain of succeeding to the throne. Octavia lost Marcellus, whom both his father-in-law and his uncle had begun to depend upon, and to place upon his shoulders the weight of the empire, a young man of keen intelligence and firm character, frugal and moderate in his desires to an extent which deserved especial admiration in one so young and so wealthy, strong to endure labour, averse to indulgence, and able to bear whatever burden his uncle might choose to lay, or may I say to pile upon, his shoulders. Augustus had very well chosen him as a foundation, for he would not have given way under any weight, however excessive. His mother never ceased to weep and sob during her whole life, never endured to listen to wholesome advice, never even allowed her thoughts to be diverted from her sorrow. She remains during her whole life just as she was during the funeral, with all the strength of her mind intently fixed upon one subject. I do not say that she lacked the courage to shake off her grief, but she refused to be comforted, thought it would be a second bereavement to lose her tears, and would not have any portrait of her darling son, nor allow any allusion to be made to him. She hated all mothers, and raged against Livia with especial fury, because it seemed as though the brilliant prospect once in store for her own child was now transferred to Livia's son. Passing all her days in darkened rooms and alone, not conversing even with her brother, she refused to accept the poems which were composed in memory of Marcellus and all the other honours paid him by literature, and closed her ears against all consolation. She lived buried and hidden from view, neglecting her accustomed duties and actually angry with the excessive splendour of her brother's prosperity, in which she shared. Though surrounded by her children and grandchildren, she would not lay aside her mourning garb, though by retaining it she seemed to put a slight upon all her relations, in thinking herself bereaved in spite of their being alive. 3. Livia lost her son Drusus, who would have been a great emperor and was already a great general. He had marched far into Germany and had planted the Roman standards in places where the very existence of the Romans was hardly known. He died on the march, his very foes treating him with respect, observing a reciprocal truce and not having the heart to wish for what would do them most service. In addition to his dying thus in his country's service, great sorrow for him was expressed by the citizens, the provinces, and the whole of Italy, through which his corpse was attended by the people of the free towns and colonies, who poured out to perform the last sad offices to him, till it reached Rome in a procession which resembled a triumph. His mother was not permitted to receive his last kiss and gather the last fond words from his dying lips. She followed the relics of her Drusus on their long journey, though every one of the funeral pyres with which all Italy was glowing seemed to renew her grief, as though she had lost him so many times. When, however, she at last laid him in the tomb, she left her sorrow there with him, and grieved no more than was becoming to a Caesar or due to a son. She did not cease to make frequent mention of the name of her Drusus, to set up his portrait in all places, both public and private, and to speak of him and listen while others spoke of him with the greatest pleasure. She lived with his memory, which none can embrace and consort with who has made it painful to himself. Choose, therefore, which of these two examples you think more commendable. If you prefer to follow the former, you will remove yourself from the number of the living. You will shun the sight both of other people's children and your own, and even of him whose loss you deplore. You will be looked upon by mothers as an omen of evil. You will refuse to take part in honourable, permissible pleasures, thinking them unbecoming for one so afflicted. You will be loath to linger above ground, and will be especially angry with your age, because it will not straightway bring your life abruptly to an end. I here put the best construction on what is really most contemptible and foreign to your character. I mean that you will show yourself unwilling to live and unable to die. If, on the other hand, showing a milder and better regulated spirit, you try to follow the example of the latter most exalted lady, you will not be in misery, nor will you wear out your life with suffering. Plague on it! What madness this is to punish oneself because one is unfortunate, and not to lessen, but to increase one's ills. You ought to display in this matter also that decent behaviour and modesty which has characterised all your life, for there is such a thing as self-restraint in grief also. You will show more respect for the youth himself, who well deserves that it should make you glad to speak and think of him, if you make him able to meet his mother with a cheerful countenance, even as he was wont to do when alive. 4. I will not invite you to practice the sterner kind of maxims, nor bid you bear the lot of humanity with more than human philosophy. Neither will I attempt to dry a mother's eyes on the very day of her son's burial. I will appear with you before an arbitrator. The matter upon which we shall join issue is, whether grief ought to be deep or unceasing. I doubt not that you will prefer the example of Julia Augusta, who was your intimate friend. She invites you to follow her method. She, in her first paroxysm, when grief is especially keen and hard to bear, betook herself for consolation to Arius, her husband's teacher in philosophy, and declared that this did her much good. More good than the thought of the Roman people, whom she was unwilling to sadden by her mourning. More than Augustus, who, staggering under the loss of one of his two chief supporters, ought not to be yet more bowed down by the sorrow of his relatives. More even than her son Tiberius, whose affection during that untimely burial of one for whom whole nations wept, made her feel that she had lost only one member of her family. This was, I imagine, his introduction to, and grounding in philosophy of, a woman peculiarly tenacious of her own opinion. Even to the present day, Julia, as far as I can tell, and I was your husband's constant companion, and knew not only what all men were allowed to know, but all the most secret thoughts of your hearts, you have been careful that no one should find anything to blame in your conduct. Not only in matters of importance, but even in trifles, you have taken pains to do nothing which you could wish common fame, that most frank judge of the acts of princes, to overlook. Nothing, I think, is more admirable than that those who are in high places should pardon many shortcomings in others, and have to ask it for none of their own. So also in this matter of mourning, you ought to act up to your maxim of doing nothing which you could wish undone, or done otherwise. 5. In the next place, I pray and beseech you not to be self-willed and beyond the management of your friends. You must be aware that none of them know how to behave, whether to mention Drusus in your presence or not, as they neither wish to wrong a noble youth by forgetting him, nor to hurt you by speaking of him. When we leave you and assemble together by ourselves, we talk freely about his sayings and doings, treating them with the respect which they deserve. In your presence, deep silence is observed about him, and thus you lose the greatest of pleasures, the hearing the praises of your son, which I doubt not you would be willing to hand down to all future ages, had you the means of doing so, even at the cost of your own life. Wherefore, endure to listen to, nay, encourage, conversation of which he is the subject, and let your ears be open to the name and memory of your son. You ought not to consider this painful, like those who in such a case think that part of their misfortune consists in listening to consolation. As it is, you have altogether run into the other extreme, and, forgetting the better aspects of your lot, look only upon its worse side. You pay no attention to the pleasure you had in your son's society and your joyful meetings with him, the sweet caress of his boyhood, the progress of his education. You fix all your attention upon that last scene of all. And to this, as though it were not shocking enough, you add every horror you can. Do not, I implore you, take a perverse pride in appearing the most unhappy of women, and reflect also that there is no great credit in behaving bravely in times of prosperity, when life glides easily with a favouring current. Neither does a calm sea and fair wind display the art of the pilot. Some foul weather is wanted to prove his courage. Like him, then, do not give way, but rather plant yourself firmly and endure whatever burden may fall upon you from above, scared though you may have been at the first roar of the tempest. There is nothing that fastens such a reproach on fortune as resignation. After this, he points out to her the son who is yet alive. He points out grandchildren from the lost one. 6. It is your trouble, Marcia, which has been dealt with here. It is beside your couch of mourning that Arius has been sitting. Change the characters, and it is you whom he has been consoling. But, on the other hand, Marcia, suppose that you have sustained a greater loss than every mother did before you. See, I am not soothing you or making light of your misfortune. If fate can be overcome by tears, let us bring tears to bear upon it. Let every day be passed in mourning, every night be spent in sorrow instead of sleep. Let your breast be torn by your own hands, your very face attacked by them, and every kind of cruelty be practised by your grief, if it will profit you. But if the dead cannot be brought back to life, however much we may beat our breasts, if destiny remains fixed and immovable forever, not to be changed by any sorrow, however great, and death does not loose his hold of anything that he has once taken away, then let our futile grief be brought to an end. Let us, then, steer our own course, and no longer allow ourselves to be driven leeward by the force of our misfortune. He is a sorry pilot who lets the waves wring his rudder from his grasp, who leaves the sails to fly loose and abandons the ship to the storm. But he who boldly grasps the helm and clings to it until the sea closes over him deserves praise, even though he be shipwrecked. 7. But, you say, sorrow for the loss of one's own children is natural. Who denies it, provided it be reasonable? For we cannot help feeling a pang, and the stoutest-hearted of us are cast down not only at the death of those dearest to us, but even when they leave us on a journey. Nevertheless, the mourning which public opinion enjoins is more than nature insists upon. Observe how intense and yet how brief are the sorrows of dumb animals. We hear a cow lowing for one or two days, nor do mares pursue their wild and senseless gallops for longer. Wild beasts, after they have tracked their lost cubs throughout the forest and often visited their plundered dens, quench their rage within a short space of time. Birds circle round their empty nests with loud and piteous cries, yet almost immediately resume their ordinary flight in silence. Nor does any creature spend long periods in sorrowing for the loss of its offspring, except man, who encourages his own grief, the measure of which depends not upon his sufferings, but upon his will. You may know that to be utterly broken down by grief is not natural, by observing that the same bereavement inflicts a deeper wound upon women than upon men, upon savages than upon civilized and cultivated persons, upon the unlearned than upon the learned. Yet those passions which derive their force from nature are equally powerful in all men. Therefore, it is clear that a passion of varying strength cannot be a natural one. Fire will burn all people equally, male and female, of every rank and every age. Steel will exhibit its cutting power on all bodies alike. And why? Because these things derive their strength from nature, which makes no distinction of persons. Poverty, grief, and ambition are felt differently by different people, according as they are influenced by habit. A rooted prejudice about the terrors of these things, though they are not really to be feared, makes a man weak and unable to endure them. 8. Moreover, that which depends upon nature is not weakened by delay, but grief is gradually effaced by time. However obstinate it may be, though it be daily renewed and be exasperated by all attempts to soothe it, yet even this becomes weakened by time, which is the most efficient means of taming its fierceness. You, Marcia, have still a mighty sorrow abiding with you. Nevertheless, it already appears to have become blunted. It is obstinate and enduring, but not so acute as it was at first, and this also will be taken from you piecemeal by succeeding years. Whenever you are engaged in other pursuits, your mind will be relieved from its burden. At present, you keep watch over yourself to prevent this. Yet there is a great difference between allowing and forcing yourself to grieve. How much more in accordance with your cultivated taste it would be to put an end to your mourning instead of looking for the end to come, and not to wait for the day when your sorrow shall cease against your will, dismiss it of your own accord. 9. Why, then, you ask, do we show such persistence in mourning for our friends, if it be not nature that bids us do so? It is because we never expect that any evil will befall ourselves before it comes. We will not be taught by seeing the misfortunes of others that they are the common inheritance of all men, but imagine that the path which we have begun to tread is free from them and less beset by dangers than that of other people. How many funerals pass our houses, yet we do not think of death. How many untimely deaths, we think only of our son's coming of age, of his service in the army, or of his succession to his father's estate. How many rich men suddenly sink into poverty before our very eyes, without its ever occurring to our minds that our own wealth is exposed to exactly the same risks. When, therefore, misfortune befalls us, we cannot help collapsing all the more completely, because we are struck, as it were, unawares. A blow which has long been foreseen falls much less heavily upon us. Do you wish to know how completely exposed you are to every stroke of fate, and that the same shafts which have transfixed others are whirling around yourself? Then imagine that you are mounting without sufficient armour to assault some city wall or some strong and lofty position manned by a great host. Expect a wound, and suppose that all those stones, arrows and darts which fill the upper air are aimed at your body. Whenever anyone falls at your side or behind your back, exclaim, "Fortune, you will not outwit me or catch me confident and heedless. I know what you are preparing to do. You have struck down another, but you aimed at me." Whoever looks upon his own affairs as though he were at the point of death? Which of us ever dares to think about banishment, want, or mourning? Who, if advised to meditate upon these subjects, would not reject the idea like an evil omen, and bid it depart from him and alight on the heads of his enemies, or even on that of his untimely adviser? I never thought it would happen. How can you think that anything will not happen, when you know that it may happen to many men, and has happened to many? That is a noble verse, and worthy of a nobler source than the stage, "What one hath suffered may befall us all." That man has lost his children. You may lose yours. That man has been convicted. Your innocence is in peril. We are deceived and weakened by this delusion, when we suffer what we never foresaw that we possibly could suffer. But by looking forward to the coming of our sorrows, we take the sting out of them when they come. 10. My Marcia, all these adventitious circumstances which glitter around us, such as children, office in the state, wealth, large halls, vestibules crowded with clients seeking vainly for admittance, a noble name, a well-born or beautiful wife, and every other thing which depends entirely upon uncertain and changeable fortune, are but furniture which is not our own, but entrusted to us on loan. None of these things are given to us outright. The stage of our lives is adorned with properties gathered from various sources and soon to be returned to their several owners. Some of them will be taken away on the first day, some on the second, and but few will remain till the end. We have, therefore, no grounds for regarding ourselves with complacency, as though the things which surround us were our own. They are only borrowed. We have the use and enjoyment of them for a time regulated by the lender, who controls his own gift. It is our duty always to be able to lay our hands upon what has been lent us with no fixed date for its return, and to restore it when called upon without a murmur. The most detestable kind of debtor is he who rails at his creditor. Hence all our relatives, both those who by the order of their birth we hope will outlive ourselves, and those who themselves will most properly wish to die before us, ought to be loved by us as persons whom we cannot be sure of having with us forever, nor even for long. We ought frequently to remind ourselves that we must love the things of this life as we would what is shortly to leave us, or indeed in the very act of leaving us. Whatever gift fortune bestows upon a man, let him think while he enjoys it that it will prove as fickle as the goddess from whom it came. Snatch what pleasure you can from your children. Allow your children in their turn to take pleasure in your society, and drain every pleasure to the dregs without any delay. We cannot reckon on tonight. Nay, I have allowed too long a delay, we cannot reckon on this hour. We must make haste. The enemy presses on behind us. Soon that society of yours will be broken up, that pleasant company will be taken by assault and dispersed. Pillage is the universal law. Unhappy creatures, know you not that life is but a flight? If you grieve for the death of your son, the fault lies with the time when he was born. For at his birth he was told that death was his doom. It is the law under which we are born, the fate which has pursued him ever since he left his mother's womb. We have come under the dominion of fortune, and a harsh and unconquerable dominion it is. At her caprice we must suffer all things, whether we deserve them or not. She maltreats our bodies with anger, insult, and cruelty. Some she burns, the fire being sometimes applied as a punishment and sometimes as a remedy. Some she imprisons, allowing it to be done at one time by our enemies, at another by our countrymen. She tosses others naked on the changeful seas, and after their struggle with the waves will not even cast them out upon the sand or the shore, but will entomb them in the belly of some huge sea monster. She wears away others to a skeleton by diverse kinds of disease, and keeps them in long suspense between life and death. She is as capricious in her rewards and punishments as a fickle, whimsical, and careless mistress is with those of her slaves. 11. Why need we weep over parts of our life? The whole of it calls for tears. New miseries assail us before we have freed ourselves from the old ones. You, therefore, who allow them to trouble you to an unreasonable extent, ought especially to restrain yourselves, and to muster all the powers of the human breast to combat your fears and your pains. Moreover, what forgetfulness of your own position and that of mankind is this? You were born a mortal, and you have given birth to mortals, yourself a weak and fragile body, liable to all diseases. Can you have hoped to produce anything strong and lasting from such unstable materials? Your son has died. In other words, he has reached that goal towards which those whom you regard as more fortunate than your offspring are still hastening. This is the point towards which move at different rates all the crowds which are squabbling in the law courts, sitting in the theatres, praying at the temples. Those whom you love and those whom you despise will both be made equal in the same ashes. This is the meaning of that command, "Know thyself," which is written on the shrine of the Pythian oracle. What is man? A potter's vessel, to be broken by the slightest shake or toss. It requires no great storm to rend you asunder. You fall to pieces wherever you strike. What is man? A weakly and frail body, naked, without any natural protection, dependent on the help of others, exposed to all the scorn of fortune. Even when his muscles are well trained, he is the prey and the food of the first wild beast he meets. Formed of weak and unstable substances, fair in outward feature, but unable to endure cold, heat, or labour, and yet falling to ruin if kept in sloth and idleness, fearing his very victuals, for he is starved if he has them not, and bursts if he has too much. He cannot be kept safe without anxious care. His breath only stays in the body on sufferance, and he has no real hold upon it. He starts at every sudden danger, every loud and unexpected noise that reaches his ears. Ever a cause of anxiety to ourselves, diseased and useless as we are, can we be surprised at the death of a creature which can be killed by a single hiccup? Is it a great undertaking to put an end to us? Why, smells, tastes, fatigue and want of sleep, food and drink, and all the very necessaries of life are mortal. Whithersoever he moves, he straightway becomes conscious of his weakness, not being able to bear all climates, falling sick after drinking strange water, breathing an air to which he is not accustomed, or from other causes and reasons of the most trifling kind, frail, sickly, entering upon his life with weeping. Yet nevertheless, what a disturbance this despicable creature makes! What ideas it conceives, forgetting its lowly condition! It exercises its mind upon matters which are immortal and eternal, and arranges the affairs of its grandchildren and great-grandchildren, while death surprises it in the midst of its far-reaching schemes, and what we call old age is but the round of a very few years. 12. Supposing that your sorrow has any method at all, is it your own sufferings or those of him who is gone that it has in view? Why do you grieve over your lost son? Is it because you have received no pleasure from him, or because you would have received more had he lived longer? If you answer that you have received no pleasure from him, you make your loss more endurable, for men miss less, when lost, what has given them no enjoyment or gladness. If, again, you admit that you have received much pleasure, it is your duty not to complain of that part which you have lost, but to return thanks for that which you have enjoyed. His rearing alone ought to have brought you a sufficient return for your labours, for it can hardly be that those who take the greatest pains to rear puppies, birds, and such like poultry objects of amusement derive a certain pleasure from the sight and touch and fawning caresses of these dumb creatures, and yet those who rear children should not find their reward in doing so. Thus, even though his industry may have gained nothing for you, his carefulness may have saved nothing for you, his foresight may have given you no advice, yet you found sufficient reward in having owned him and loved him. But, you say, it might have lasted longer. True, but you have been dealt better with than if you had never had a son, for, supposing you were given your choice, which is the better lot, to be happy for a short time or not at all? It is better to enjoy pleasures which soon leave us than to enjoy none at all. Which, again, would you choose, to have had one who was a disgrace to you and who merely filled the position and owned the name of your son, or one of such noble character as your son's was, a youth who soon grew discreet and dutiful, soon became a husband and a father, soon became eager for public honours, and soon obtained the priesthood, winning his way to all these admirable things with equally admirable speed? It falls to scarcely anyone's lot to enjoy great prosperity and also to enjoy it for a long time. Only a dull kind of happiness can last for long and accompany us to the end of our lives. The immortal gods, who did not intend to give you a son for long, gave you one who was straightway what another would have required long training to become. You cannot even say that you have been specially marked by the gods for misfortune because you have had no pleasure in your son. Look at any company of people, whether they be known to you or not. Everywhere you will see some who have endured greater misfortunes than your own. Great generals and princes have undergone like bereavements. Mythology tells us that the gods themselves are not exempt from them, its aim, I suppose, being to lighten our sorrow at death by the thought that even deities are subject to it. Look around, I repeat, at everyone. You cannot mention any house so miserable as not to find comfort in the fact of another being yet more miserable. I do not, by Hercules, think so ill of your principles as to suppose that you would bear your sorrow more lightly were I to show you an enormous company of mourners. That is a spiteful sort of consolation which we derive from the number of our fellow sufferers. Nevertheless, I will quote some instances, not indeed in order to teach you that this often befalls men, for it is absurd to multiply examples of men's mortality, but to let you know that there have been many who have lightened their misfortunes by patient endurance of them. I will begin with the luckiest man of all. Lucius Sulla lost his son, yet this did not impair either the spitefulness or the brilliant valour which he displayed at the expense of his enemies and his countrymen alike. Nor did it make him appear to have assumed his well-known title untruly, that he did so after his son's death, fearing neither the hatred of men by whose sufferings that excessive prosperity of his was purchased, nor the ill will of the gods, to whom it was a reproach that Sulla should be so truly the fortunate. What, however, Sulla's real character was, may pass among questions still undecided. Even his enemies will admit that he took up arms with honour, and laid them aside with honour. His example proves the point at issue, that an evil which befalls even the most prosperous cannot be one of the first magnitude. 13. That Greece cannot boast unduly of that father who, being in the act of offering sacrifice when he heard the news of his son's death, merely ordered the flute player to be silent and removed the garland from his head, but accomplished all the rest of the ceremony in due form, is due to a Roman, Pulvillus, the high priest. When he was in the act of holding the doorpost and dedicating the capital, the news of his son's death was brought to him. He pretended not to hear it, and pronounced the form of words proper for the high priest on such an occasion, without his prayer being interrupted by a single groan, begging that Jupiter would show himself gracious at the very instant that he heard his son's name mentioned as dead. Do you imagine that this man's mourning knew no end, if the first day and the first shock could not drive him, though a father, away from the public altar of the state, or cause him to mar the ceremony of dedication by words of ill omen? Worthy indeed of the most exalted priesthood was he who ceased not to revere the gods even when they were angry. Yet he, after he had gone home, filled his eyes with tears, said a few words of lamentation, and performed the rites with which it was then customary to honour the dead, resumed the expression of countenance which he had worn in the capital. Paulus, about the time of his magnificent triumph, in which he drove Perses in chains before his car, gave two of his sons to be adopted into other families, and buried those whom he had kept for himself. What, think you, must those whom he kept have been when Scipio was one of those whom he gave away? It was not without emotion that the Roman people looked upon Paulus's empty chariot. Nevertheless, he made a speech to them, and returned thanks to the gods for having granted his prayer, for he had prayed that, if any offering to Nemesis were due in consequence of the stupendous victory which he had won, it might be paid at his own expense rather than that of his country. Do you see how magnanimously he bore his loss? He even congratulated himself on being left childless, though who had more to suffer by such a change? He lost at once his comforters and his helpers. Yet Perses did not have the pleasure of seeing Paulus look sorrowful. 14. Why should I lead you on through the endless series of great men and pick out the unhappy ones as though it were not more difficult to find happy ones? For how few households have remained possessed of all their members until the end? What one is there that has not suffered some loss? Take any one year you please, and name the consuls for it, if you like that of Lucius Bibulus and Gaius Caesar. You will see that, though these colleagues were each other's bitterest enemies, yet their fortunes agreed. Lucius Bibulus, a man more remarkable for goodness than for strength of character, had both his sons murdered at the same time, and even insulted by the Egyptian soldiery, so that the agent of his bereavement was as much a subject for tears as the bereavement itself. Nevertheless, Bibulus, who during the whole of his year of office had remained hidden in his house, to cast reproach upon his colleague Caesar on the day following that upon which he heard of both his sons' deaths, came forth and went through the routine business of his magistracy. Who could devote less than one day to mourning for two sons? Thus soon did he end his mourning for his children, although he had mourned a whole year for his consulship. Gaius Caesar, after having traversed Britain and not allowed even the ocean to set bounds to his successes, heard of the death of his daughter, which hurried on the crisis of affairs. Already Gnaeus Pompeius stood before his eyes, a man who would ill endure that anyone besides himself should become a great power in the state, and one who was likely to place a check upon his advancement, which he regarded as onerous even when each gained by the other's rise. Yet within 3 days' time he resumed his duties as general, and conquered his grief as quickly as he was wont to conquer everything else. 15. Why need I remind you of the deaths of the other Caesars, whom fortune appears to me sometimes to have outraged in order that even by their deaths they might be useful to mankind, by proving that not even they, although they were styled sons of gods and fathers of gods to come, could exercise the same power over their own fortunes which they did over those of others. The Emperor Augustus lost his children and his grandchildren, and after all the family of Caesar had perished, was obliged to prop his empty house by adopting a son. Yet he bore his losses as bravely as though he were already personally concerned in the honour of the gods, and as though it were especially to his interest that no one should complain of the injustice of heaven. Tiberius Caesar lost both the son he begot and the son whom he adopted, yet he himself pronounced a panegyric upon his son from the rostra, and stood in full view of the corpse, which merely had a curtain on one side to prevent the eyes of the high priest resting upon the dead body, and did not change his countenance, though all the Romans wept. He gave Sejanus, who stood by his side, a proof of how patiently he could endure the loss of his relatives. See you not what numbers of most eminent men there have been, none of whom have been spared by this blight which prostrates us all? Men, too, adorned with every grace of character and every distinction that public or private life can confer. It appears as though this plague moved in a regular orbit, and spread ruin and desolation among us all, without distinction of persons, all being alike its prey. Bid any number of individuals tell you the story of their lives, you will find that all have paid some penalty for being born. 16. I know what you will say. You quote men as examples. You forget that it is a woman that you are trying to console. Yet who would say that nature has dealt grudgingly with the minds of women and stunted their virtues? Believe me, they have the same intellectual power as men and the same capacity for honourable and generous action. If trained to do so, they are just as able to endure sorrow or labour. Ye good gods, do I say this in the very city in which Lucretia and Brutus removed the yoke of kings from the necks of the Romans? We owe liberty to Brutus, but we owe Brutus to Lucretia. In which Cloelia, for the sublime courage with which she scorns both the enemy and the river, has been almost reckoned as a man. The statue of Cloelia mounted on horseback, in that busiest of thoroughfares, the Sacred Way, continually reproaches the youth of the present day, who never mount anything but a cushioned seat in a carriage, with journeying in such a fashion through that very city in which we enrolled even women among our knights. If you wish me to point out to you examples of women who have bravely endured the loss of their children, I shall not go far afield to search for them. In one family I can quote two Cornelias, one the daughter of Scipio and the mother of the Gracchi, who made acknowledgement of the birth of her 12 children by burying them all. Nor was it so hard to do this in the case of the others, whose birth and death were alike unknown to the public, but she beheld the murdered and unburied corpses of both Tiberius Gracchus and Gaius Gracchus, whom even those who will not call them good must admit were great men. Yet to those who tried to console her and called her unfortunate, she answered, "I shall never cease to call myself happy, because I am the mother of the Gracchi." Cornelia, the wife of Livius Drusus, lost by the hands of an unknown assassin a young son of great distinction, who was treading in the footsteps of the Gracchi, and was murdered in his own house just when he had so many bills halfway through the process of becoming law. Nevertheless, she bore the untimely and unavenged death of her son with as lofty a spirit as he had shown in carrying his laws. Will you not, Marcia, forgive fortune because she has not refrained from striking you with the darts which she has launched at the Scipios and the mothers and daughters of the Scipios, and with which she has attacked the Caesars themselves? Life is full of misfortunes. Our path is beset with them. No one can make a long peace, nay, scarcely an armistice with fortune. You, Marcia, have borne 4 children. Now they say that no dart which is hurled into a close column of soldiers can fail to hit 1. Ought you then to wonder at not having been able to lead along such a company without exciting the ill will of fortune or suffering loss at her hands? But, you say, fortune has treated me unfairly, for she not only has bereaved me of my son, but chose my best beloved to deprive me of. Yet you can never say that you have been wronged if you divide the stakes equally with an antagonist who is stronger than yourself. Fortune has left you 2 daughters and their children. She has not even taken away altogether him who you now mourn for, forgetful of his elder brother. You have 2 daughters by him, who, if you support them ill, will prove great burdens, but if well, great comforts to you. You ought to prevail upon yourself, when you see them, to let them remind you of your son and not of your grief. When a husbandman's trees have either been torn up, roots and all, by the wind, or broken off short by the force of a hurricane, he takes care of what is left of their stock. Straightway plant seeds or cuttings in the place of those which he has lost, and in a moment, for time is as swift in repairing losses as in causing them, more nourishing trees are growing than were there before. Take, then, in the place of your Metilius, these his 2 daughters, and by their 2-fold consolation lighten your single sorrow. True, human nature is so constituted as to love nothing so much as what it has lost, and our yearning after those who have been taken from us makes us judge unfairly of those who are left to us. Nevertheless, if you choose to reckon up how merciful fortune has been to you, even in her anger, you will feel that you have more than enough to console you. Look at all your grandchildren, and your 2 daughters, and say also, Marcia, I should indeed be cast down if everyone's fortune followed his deserts, and if no evil ever befell good men. But as it is, I perceive that no distinction is made, and that the bad and the good are both harassed alike. 17. Still, it is a sad thing to lose a young man whom you have brought up, just as he was becoming a defence and a pride both to his mother and to his country. No one denies that it is sad, but it is the common lot of mortals. You were born to lose others, to be lost, to hope, to fear, to destroy your own peace and that of others, to fear and yet to long for death, and, worst of all, never to know what your real position is. If you were about to journey to Syracuse and someone were to say, learn beforehand all the discomforts and all the pleasures of your coming voyage, and then set sail, the sights which you will enjoy will be as follows. First, you will see the island itself, now separated from Italy by a narrow strait, but which, we know, once formed part of the mainland. The sea suddenly broke through and severed Sicilia from the western shore. Next, as you will be able to sail close to Charybdis, of which the poets have sung, you will see that greediest of whirlpools, quite smooth if no south wind be blowing, but whenever there is a gale from that quarter, sucking down ships into a huge and deep abyss. You will see the fountain of Arethusa, so famed in song, with its waters bright and pellucid to the very bottom, and pouring forth an icy stream which it either finds on the spot or else plunges it underground, conveys it thither as a separate river beneath so many seas, free from any mixture of less pure water, and there brings it again to the surface. You will see a harbour which is more sheltered than all the others in the world, whether they be natural or improved by human art for the protection of shipping, so safe that even the most violent storms are powerless to disturb it. You will see the place where the power of Athens was broken, where that natural prison, hewn deep among precipices of rock, received so many thousands of captives. You will see the great city itself, occupying a wider site than many capitals, an extremely warm resort in winter, where not a single day passes without sunshine. But when you have observed all this, you must remember that the advantages of its winter climate are counterbalanced by a hot and pestilential summer. That here will be the tyrant Dionysius, the destroyer of freedom, of justice and of law, who is greedy of power even after conversing with Plato, and of life even after he has been exiled. That he will burn some, flog others, and behead others for slight offences. That he will exercise his lust upon both sexes. You have now heard all that can attract you thither, and all that can deter you from going. Now, then, either set sail or remain at home. If, after this declaration, anybody were to say that he wished to go to Syracuse, he could blame no one but himself for what befell him there, because he would not stumble upon it unknowingly, but would have gone thither fully aware of what was before him. To everyone, nature says, I do not deceive any person. If you choose to have children, they may be handsome, or they may be deformed. Perhaps they will be born dumb. One of them may perhaps prove the saviour of his country, or perhaps its betrayer. You need not despair of their being raised to such honour that for their sake no one will dare to speak evil of you. Yet remember that they may reach such a pitch of infamy as themselves to become curses to you. There is nothing to prevent their performing the last offices for you, and your panegyric being spoken by your children. But hold yourself prepared, nevertheless, to place a son as boy, man, or greybeard upon the funeral pyre, for years have nothing to do with the matter, since every sort of funeral in which a parent buries his children must alike be untimely. If you still choose to rear children, after I have explained these conditions to you, you render yourself incapable of blaming the gods, for they never guaranteed anything to you. 18. You may make this simile apply to your whole entrance into life. I have explained to you what attractions and what drawbacks there would be if you were thinking of going to Syracuse. Now suppose that I were to come and give you advice when you were going to be born. You are about, I would say, to enter a city of which both gods and men are citizens, a city which contains the whole universe, which is bound by irrevocable and eternal laws, and wherein the heavenly bodies run their unwearied courses. You will see therein innumerable twinkling stars, and the sun, whose single light pervades every place, who by his daily course marks the times of day and night, and by his yearly course makes a more equal division between summer and winter. You will see his place taken by night by the moon, who borrows at her meetings with her brother a gentle and softer light, and who at one time is invisible, at another hangs full-faced above the earth, ever waxing and waning, each phase unlike the last. You will see five stars moving in the opposite direction to the others, stemming the whirl of the skies towards the west. On the slightest motions of these depend the fortunes of nations, and according as the aspect of the planets is auspicious or malignant, the greatest empires rise and fall. You will see the wonder of the gathering clouds, the falling showers, the zigzag lightning, the crashing together of the heavens. When sated with the wonders above, you turn your eyes towards the earth. They will be met by objects of different yet equally admirable aspect. On one side, a boundless expanse of open plains, on another, the towering peaks of lofty and snow-clad mountains, the downward course of rivers, some streams running eastward, some westward, from the same source, the woods which wave even on the mountain tops, the vast forests with all the creatures that dwell therein, and the confused harmony of the birds. The variously placed cities, the nations which natural obstacles keep secluded from the world, some of whom withdraw themselves to lofty mountains, while others dwell in fear and trembling on the sloping banks of rivers. The crops which are assisted by cultivation, and the trees which bear fruit even without it, the rivers that flow gently through the meadows, the lovely bays and shores that curve inwards to form harbours, the countless islands scattered over the main, which break and spangle the seas. What of the brilliancy of stones and gems, the gold that rolls amid the sands of rushing streams, the heavenly-born fires that burst forth from the midst of the earth and even from the midst of the sea, the ocean itself that binds land to land, dividing the nations by its threefold indentations and boiling up with mighty rage, swimming among its waves, making them disturbed and swelling without wind, you will see animals exceeding the size of any that belong to the land, some clumsy and requiring others to guide their movements, some swift and moving faster than the utmost efforts of rowers, some of them that drink in the waters and blow them out again to the great perils of those who sail near them. You will see here ships seeking for unknown lands, and will see that man's audacity leaves nothing unattempted, and you will yourself be both a witness and a sharer in great attempts. You will both learn and teach the arts by which men's lives are supplied with necessaries, are adorned and are ruled. But in this same place there will be a thousand pestilences, fatal to both body and mind. There will be wars and highway robberies, poisonings and shipwrecks, extremes of climate and excesses of body, untimely griefs for our dearest ones, and death for ourselves, of which we cannot tell whether it will be easy or by torture at the hands of the executioner. Now consider and weigh carefully in your own mind which you would choose. If you wish to enjoy these blessings, you must pass through these pains. Do you answer that you choose to live? Of course. Nay, I thought you would not enter upon that which the least diminution causes pain. Live, then, as has been agreed on. You say, no one has asked my opinion. Our parents' opinion was taken about us, when, knowing what the conditions of life are, they brought us into it. 19. But, to come to topics of consolation, in the first place, consider, if you please, to what our remedies must be applied, and next, in what way. It is regret for the absence of his loved one which causes a mourner to grieve, yet it is clear that this in itself is bearable enough, for we do not weep at their being absent or intending to be absent during their lifetime, although when they leave our sight we have no more pleasure in them. What tortures us, therefore, is an idea. Now every evil is just as great as we consider it to be. We have, therefore, the remedy in our own hands. Let us suppose that they are on a journey. Let us deceive ourselves. We have sent them away, or rather, we have sent them on in advance to a place whither we shall soon follow them. Besides this, mourners are wont to suffer from the thought, I shall have no one to protect me, no one to avenge me when I am scorned. To use a very disreputable but very true mode of consolation, I may say that in our country the loss of children bestows more influence than it takes away, and loneliness, which used to bring the aged to ruin, now makes them so powerful that some old men have pretended to pick quarrels with their sons, have disowned their own children, and have made themselves childless by their own act. I know what you will say. My own losses do not grieve me. And indeed, a man does not deserve to be consoled if he is sorry for his son's death as he would be for that of a slave, who is capable of seeing anything in his son beyond his son's self. What, then, Marcia, is it that grieves you? Is it that your son has died, or that he did not live long? If it be his having died, then you ought always to have grieved, for you always knew that he would die. Reflect that the dead suffer no evils, that all those stories which make us dread the netherworld are mere fables, that he who dies need fear no darkness, no prison, no blazing streams of fire, no river of Lethe, no judgment seat before which he must appear, and that death is such utter freedom that he need fear no more despots. All that is a fantasy of the poets, who have terrified us without a cause. Death is a release from and an end of all pains. Beyond it our sufferings cannot extend. It restores us to the peaceful rest in which we lay before we were born. If anyone pities the dead, he ought also to pity those who have not been born. Death is neither a good nor a bad thing, for that alone which is something can be a good or bad thing. But that which is nothing and reduces all things to nothing does not hand us over to either fortune, because good and bad require some material to work upon. Fortune cannot take hold of that which nature has let go, nor can a man be unhappy if he is nothing. Your son has passed beyond the border of the country where men are forced to labour. He has reached deep and everlasting peace. He feels no fear of want, no anxiety about his riches, no stings of lust that tears the heart in guise of pleasure. He knows no envy of another's prosperity. He is not crushed by the weight of his own. Even his chaste tears are not wounded by any ribaldry. He is menaced by no disaster, either to his country or to himself. He does not hang, full of anxiety, upon the issues of events, to reap even greater uncertainty as his reward. He has at last taken up a position from which nothing can dislodge him, where nothing can make him afraid. 20. Oh, how little do men understand their own misery, that they do not praise and look forward to death as the best discovery of nature, whether because it hedges in happiness or because it drives away misery, because it puts an end to the sated weariness of old age, cuts down youth in its bloom while still full of hope of better things, or calls home childhood before the harsher stages of life are reached. It is the end of all men, a relief to many, a desire to some, and it treats none so well as those to whom it comes before they call for it. Death frees the slave, though his master wills it not. It lightens the captive's chains. It leads out of prison those whom headstrong power has forbidden to quit it. It points out to exiles whose minds and eyes are ever turned towards their own country that it makes no difference under what people's soil one lies. When fortune has unjustly divided the common stock and has given over one man to another, though they were born with equal rights, death makes them all equal. After death, no one acts any more at another's bidding. In death, no man suffers any more from the sense of his low position. It is open to all. It is what your father, Marcia, longed for. It is this, I say, that renders it no misery to be born, which enables me to face the threatenings of misfortune without quailing, and to keep my mind unharmed and able to command itself. I have a last appeal. I see before me crosses not all alike, but differently made by different peoples. Some hang a man head downwards, some force a stick upwards through his groin, some stretch out his arms on a forked gibbet. I see cords, scourges, and instruments of torture for each limb and each joint, but I see death also. There are bloodthirsty enemies, there are overbearing fellow countrymen, but where they are, there I see death also. Slavery is not grievous if a man can gain his freedom by one step as soon as he becomes tired of thraldom. Life, it is thanks to death that I hold thee so dear. Think how great a blessing is a timely death, how many have been injured by living longer than they ought. If sickness had carried off that glory and support of the empire, Gnaeus Pompeius at Naples, he would have died the undoubted head of the Roman people. But as it was, a short extension of time cast him down from his pinnacle of fame. He beheld his legions slaughtered before his eyes, and what a sad relic of that battle, in which the Senate formed the first line, was the survival of the general. He saw his Egyptian butcher and offered his body, hallowed by so many victories, to a guardsman's sword, although even had he been unhurt, he would have regretted his safety. For what could have been more infamous than that a Pompeius should owe his life to the clemency of a king? If Marcus Cicero had fallen at the time when he avoided those daggers which Catiline aimed equally at him and at his country, he might have died as the saviour of the commonwealth which he had set free. If his death had even followed upon that of his daughter, he might have died happy. He would not then have seen swords drawn for the slaughter of Roman citizens, the goods of the murdered divided among the murderers, that men might pay from their own purse the price of their own blood, the public auction of the consul's spoil in the civil war, the public letting out of murder to be done, brigandage, war, pillage, hosts of Catilines. Would it not have been a good thing for Marcus Cato if the sea had swallowed him up when he was returning from Cyprus after sequestering the king's hereditary possessions, even if that very money which he was bringing to pay the soldiers in the civil war had been lost with him? He certainly would have been able to boast that no one would dare to do wrong in the presence of a Cato. As it was, the extension of his life for a very few more years forced one who was born for personal and political freedom to flee from Caesar and become Pompeius's follower. Premature death, therefore, did him no evil. Indeed, it put an end to the power of any evil to hurt him. 21. Yet, you say, he perished too soon and untimely. In the first place, suppose that he had lived to extreme old age. Let him continue alive to the extreme limits of human existence. How much is it, after all? Born for a very brief space of time, we regard this life as an inn which we are soon to quit, that it may be made ready for the coming guest. Do I speak of our lives, which we know roll away incredibly fast? Reckon up the centuries of cities. You will find that even those which boast of their antiquity have not existed for long. All human works are brief and fleeting. They take up no part whatever of infinite time. Tried by the standard of the universe, we regard this earth of ours, with all its cities, nations, rivers, and seaboard, as a mere point. Our life occupies less than a point when compared with all time, the measure of which exceeds that of the world, for indeed the world is contained many times in it. Of what importance, then, can it be to lengthen that which, however much you add to it, will never be much more than nothing? We can only make our lives long by one expedient, that is, by being satisfied with their length. You may tell me of long-lived men whose length of days has been celebrated by tradition. You may assign 110 years apiece to them, yet when you allow your mind to conceive the idea of eternity, there will be no difference between the shortest and the longest life, if you compare the time during which anyone has been alive with that during which he has not been alive. In the next place, when he died, his life was complete. He had lived as long as he needed to live. There was nothing left for him to accomplish. All men do not grow old at the same age, nor indeed do all animals. Some are wearied out by life at 14 years of age, and what is only the first stage of life with man is their extreme limit of longevity. To each man a varying length of days has been assigned. No one dies before his time, because he was not destined to live any longer than he did. Everyone's end is fixed, and will always remain where it has been placed. Neither industry nor favour will move it on any further. Believe, then, that you lost him by advice. He took all that was his own, and reached the goal allotted to his life. So you need not burden yourself with the thought, he might have lived longer. His life has not been cut short, nor does chance ever cut short our years. Every man receives as much as was promised to him. The fates go their own way, and neither add anything nor take anything away from what they have once promised. Prayers and endeavours are all in vain. Each man will have as much life as his first day placed to his credit. From the time when he first saw the light, he has entered on the path that leads to death, and is drawing nearer to his doom. Those same years which were added to his youth were subtracted from his life. We all fall into this mistake of supposing that it is only old men, already in the decline of life, who are drawing near to death, whereas our first infancy, our youth, indeed every time of life, leads thither. The fates ply their own work. They take from us the consciousness of our death, and, the better to conceal its approaches, death lurks under the very names we give to life. Infancy changes into boyhood. Maturity swallows up the boy, old age the man. These stages themselves, if you reckon them properly, are so many losses. 22. Do you complain, Marcia, that your son did not live as long as he might have done? How do you know that it was to his advantage to live longer, whether his interest was not served by death? Whom can you find at the present time whose fortunes are grounded on such sure foundations that they have nothing to fear in the future? All human affairs are evanescent and perishable, nor is any part of our life so frail and liable to accident as that which we especially enjoy. We ought, therefore, to pray for death when our fortune is at its best, because so great is the uncertainty and turmoil in which we live that we can be sure of nothing but what is past. Think of your son's handsome person, which you had guarded in perfect purity among all the temptations of a voluptuous capital. Who could have undertaken to keep that clear of all diseases, so that it might preserve its beauty of form unimpaired even to old age? Think of the many taints of the mind, for fine dispositions do not always continue to their life's end to make good the promise of their youth, but have often been broken down. Either extravagance, all the more shameful for being indulged in late in life, takes possession of men and makes their well-begun lives end in disgrace, or they devote their entire thoughts to the eating-house and the belly, and they become interested in nothing save what they shall eat and what they shall drink. Add to this conflagrations, falling houses, shipwrecks, the agonizing operations of surgeons who cut pieces of bone out of men's living bodies, plunge their whole hands into their entrails, and inflict more than one kind of pain to effect the cure of shameful diseases. After these come exile. Your son was not more innocent than Rutilius. Imprisonment. He was not wiser than Socrates. The piercing of one's breast by a self-inflicted wound. He was not of holier life than Cato. When you look at these examples, you will perceive that nature deals very kindly with those whom she puts speedily in a place of safety, because there awaited them the payment of some such price as this for their lives. Nothing is so deceptive, nothing is so treacherous as human life. By Hercules, were it not given to men before they could form an opinion, no one would take it. Not to be born, therefore, is the happiest lot of all, and the nearest thing to this, I imagine, is that we should soon finish our strife here and be restored again to our former rest. Recall to your mind that time so painful to you, during which Sejanus handed over your father as a present to his client Satrius Secundus. He was angry with him about something or other which he had said with too great freedom, because he was not able to keep silence and see Sejanus climbing up to take his seat upon our necks, which would have been bad enough had he been placed there by his master. He was decreed the honour of a statue to be set up in the theatre of Pompeius, which had been burned down and was being restored by Caesar. Cordus exclaimed, "Now the theatre was really destroyed." What, then? should he not burst with spite at a Sejanus being set up over the ashes of Aeneas Pompeius, at a faithless soldier being commemorated within the memorial of a consummate commander. The inscription was set up, and those keen-scented hounds whom Sejanus used to feed on human blood to make them tame towards himself and fierce to all the world beside, began to bay around their victim and even to make premature snaps at him. What was he to do? If he chose to live, he must gain the consent of Sejanus. If to die, he must gain that of his daughter, and neither of them could have been persuaded to grant it. He therefore determined to deceive his daughter, and, having taken a bath in order to weaken himself still further, he retired to his bedchamber on the pretense of taking a meal there. After dismissing his slaves, he threw some of the food out of the window, that he might appear to have eaten it. Then he took no supper, making the excuse that he had already had enough food in his chamber. This he continued to do on the second and the third day. The fourth betrayed his condition by his bodily weakness. "So, embracing you, my dearest daughter," said he, "from whom I have never throughout your whole life concealed aught but this, I have begun my journey towards death, and have already travelled halfway thither. You cannot and ought not to call me back." So saying, he ordered all light to be excluded from the room, and shut himself up in the darkness. When his determination became known, there was a general feeling of pleasure at the prey being snatched out of the jaws of those ravening wolves. His prosecutors, at the instance of Sejanus, went to the judgment seat of the consuls, complained that Cordus was dying, and begged the consuls to interpose to prevent his doing what they themselves had driven him to do. So true was it that Cordus appeared to them to be escaping. An important matter was at stake, namely whether the accused should lose the right to die. While this point was being debated, and the prosecutors were going to attend the court a second time, he had set himself free from them. Do you see, Marcia, how suddenly evil days come upon a man? And do you weep because one of your family could not avoid dying? One of your family was within a very little of not being allowed to die. 23. Besides the fact that everything that is future is uncertain, and the only certainty is that it is more likely to turn out ill than well, our spirits find the path to the gods above easiest when it is soon allowed to leave the society of mankind, because it has then contracted fewest impurities to weigh it down, if set free before they become hardened worldlings, before earthly things have sunk too deep into them, they fly all the more lightly back to the place from whence they came, and all the more easily wash away the stains and defilements which they may have contracted. Great minds never love to linger long in the body. They are eager to burst its bonds and escape from it. They chafe at the narrowness of their prison, having been wont to wander through space and from aloft in the upper air to look down with contempt upon human affairs. Hence it is that Plato declares that the wise man's mind is entirely given up to death, longs for it, contemplates it, and through his eagerness for it is always striving after things which lie beyond this life. Why, Marcia, when you saw him, while yet young, displaying the wisdom of age, with a mind that could rise superior to all sensual enjoyments, faultless and without a blemish, able to win riches without greediness, public office without ambition, pleasure without extravagance, did you suppose it would long be your lot to keep him safe by your side? Whatever has arrived at perfection is ripe for dissolution. Consummate virtue flees away and betakes itself out of our sight, and those things which come to maturity in the first stage of their being do not wait for the last. The brighter a fire glows, the sooner it goes out. It lasts longer when it is made up with bad and slowly burning fuel, and shows a dull light through a cloud of smoke. Its being poorly fed makes it linger all the longer. So also the more brilliant men's minds, the shorter lived they are. For when there is no room for further growth, the end is near. Fabianus tells us what our parents themselves have seen, that there was at Rome a boy of gigantic stature, exceeding that of a man, but he soon died, and every sensible person always said that he would soon die, for he could not live to reach the age which he had assumed before it was due. So it is. To complete maturity is a proof that destruction is near, and the end approaches when growth is over. 24. Begin to reckon his age not by years but by virtues. He lived long enough. He was left as a ward in the care of guardians up to his 14th year, and never passed out of that of his mother. When he had a household of his own, he was loath to leave yours, and continued to dwell under his mother's roof, though few sons can endure to live under their father's. Though a youth whose height, beauty, and vigour of body destined him for the army, yet he refused to serve, that he might not be separated from you. Consider, Marcia, how seldom mothers who live in separate houses see their children. Consider how they lose and pass in anxiety all those years during which they have sons in the army, and you will see that this time, none of which you lost, was of considerable extent. He never went out of your sight. It was under your eyes that he applied himself to the cultivation of an admirable intellect, and one which would have rivaled that of his grandfather, had it not been hindered by shyness, which has concealed many men's accomplishments. Though a youth of unusual beauty, and living among such throngs of women who made it their business to seduce men, he gratified the wishes of none of them, and when the effrontery of some led them so far as to actually tempt him, he blushed as deeply at having found favour in their eyes as though he had been guilty. By this holiness of life he caused himself, while yet quite a boy, to be thought worthy of the priesthood, which no doubt he owed to his mother's influence. But even his mother's influence would have had no weight if the candidate for whom it was exerted had been unfit for the post. Dwell upon these virtues, and nurse your son, as it were, in your lap. Now he is more at leisure to respond to your caresses. He has nothing to call him away from you. He will never be an anxiety or a sorrow to you. You have grieved at the only grief so good a son could cause you. All else is beyond the power of fortune to harm, and is full of pleasure, if only you know how to make use of your son, if you do but know what his most precious quality was. It is merely the outward semblance of your son that has perished, his likeness, and that not a very good one. He himself is immortal, and is now in a far better state, set free from the burden of all that was not his own, and left simply by himself. All this apparatus which you see about us of bones and sinews, this covering of skin, this face, these our servants, the hands, and all the rest of our environment, are but chains and darkness to the soul. They overwhelm it, choke it, corrupt it, fill it with false ideas, and keep it at a distance from its own true sphere. It has to struggle continually against this burden of the flesh, lest it be dragged down and sunk by it. It ever strives to rise up again to the place from whence it was sent down on earth. There eternal rest awaits it. There it will behold what is pure and clear, in place of what is foul and turbid. 25. You need not, therefore, hasten to the burial place of your son. That which lies there is but the worst part of him, and that which gave him the most trouble, only bones and ashes, which are no more parts of him than clothes or other coverings of his body. He is complete, and without leaving any part of himself behind on earth, has taken wing and gone away altogether. He has tarried a brief space above us while his soul was being cleansed and purified from the vices and rust which all mortal lives must contract, and from thence he will rise to the high heavens and join the souls of the blessed. A saintly company will welcome him thither, Scipios and Catos. And among the rest of those who have held life cheap and set themselves free, thanks to death, albeit all there are alike akin, your father, Marcia, will embrace his grandson as he rejoices in the unwonted light, will teach him the motion of the stars, which are so near to them, and introduce him with joy into all the secrets of nature, not by guesswork, but by real knowledge. Even as a stranger is grateful to one who shows him the way about an unknown city, so is a searcher after the causes of what he sees in the heavens to one of his own family who can explain them to him. He will delight in gazing deep down upon the earth, for it is a delight to look down from aloft at what one has left below. Bear yourself, therefore, Marcia, as though you were placed before the eyes of your father and your son, yet not such as you knew them, but far loftier beings, placed in a higher sphere. Blush, then, to do any mean or common action, or to weep for those your relatives who have been changed for the better. Free to roam through the open, boundless realms of the ever-living universe, they are not hindered in their course by intervening seas, lofty mountains, impassable valleys, or the treacherous flats of the Syrtes. They find a level path everywhere, are swift and ready of motion, and are permeated in their turn by the stars, and dwell together with them. 26. Imagine then, Marcia, that your father, whose influence over you was as great as yours over your son, no longer in that frame of mind in which he deplored the civil wars, or in which he forever proscribed those who would have proscribed him, but in a mood as much more joyful as his abode now is higher than of old, is saying, as he looks down from the height of heaven, "My daughter, why does this sorrow possess you for so long? Why do you live in such ignorance of the truth as to think that your son has been unfairly dealt with because he has returned to his ancestors in his prime, without decay of body or mind, leaving his family flourishing? Do you not know with what storms fortune unsettles everything, how she proves kind and compliant to none save to those who have the fewest possible dealings with her? Need I remind you of kings who would have been the happiest of mortals had death sooner withdrawn them from the ruin which was approaching them, or of Roman generals whose greatness had but a few years been taken from their lives would have wanted nothing to render it complete, or of men of the highest distinction and noblest birth who have calmly offered their necks to the stroke of a soldier's sword? Look at your father and your grandfather. The former fell into the hands of a foreign murderer. I allowed no man to take any liberties with me, and my abstinence from food showed that my spirit was as great as my writings had represented it. Why, then, should that member of our household who died most happily of all be mourned in it the longest? We have all assembled together, and, not being plunged in utter darkness, we see that with you on earth there is nothing to be wished for, nothing grand or magnificent, but all is mean, sad, anxious, and hardly receives a fractional part of the clear light in which we dwell. I need not say that here there are no frantic charges of rival armies, no fleets shattering one another, no parricides, actual or meditated, no courts where men babble over lawsuits for days together. Here nothing is underhand, all hearts and minds are open and unveiled. Our life is public and known to all, and that we command a view of all time and of things to come. I used to take pleasure in compiling the history of what took place in one century among a few people in the most out-of-the-way corner of the world. Here I enjoy the spectacle of all the centuries, the whole chain of events from age to age, as long as years have been. I may view kingdoms when they rise and when they fall, and behold the ruin of cities and the new channels made by the sea. if it will be any consolation to you in your bereavement to know that it is the common lot of all, be assured that nothing will continue to stand in the place in which it now stands, but that time will lay everything low and bear it away with itself. It will sport not only with men, for how small a part are they of the dominion of fortune, but with districts, provinces, quarters of the world. It will efface entire mountains, and in other places will pile new rocks on high. It will dry up seas, change the course of rivers, destroy the intercourse of nation with nation, and break up the communion and fellowship of the human race. In other regions, it will swallow up cities by opening vast chasms in the earth, will shake them with earthquakes, will breathe forth pestilence from the netherworld, cover all habitable ground with inundations, and destroy every creature in the flooded world, or burn up all mortals by a huge conflagration. When the time shall arrive for the world to be brought to an end, that it may begin its life anew, all the forces of nature will perish in conflict with one another. The stars will be dashed together, and all the lights which now gleam in regular order in various parts of the sky will then blaze in one fire with all their fuel burning at once. Then we also, the souls of the blessed and the heirs of eternal life, whenever God thinks fit to reconstruct the universe, when all things are settling down again, we also, being a small accessory to the universal wreck, shall be changed into our old elements. Happy is your son, Marcia, in that he already knows this.